It is the 10th of May. It is Mother's Day.
Yay, Mommy!
And we have an abridged class tonight because of the third day school dinner. We are on page 208. And we begin the very pivotal story of Yehuda and Tamar, which is the ancestry of David HaMelech, King David, which ultimately is therefore the ancestry of Mashiach. Now the story here has to be understood in context with the background that is necessary for it. So I'm going to begin with a little bit of an introduction. Some of you may have heard part of this before, maybe all of this before, but it's important in order to read the story carefully and understand that we need the background. We have spoken before with the youngest member of our class. Okay. It's fine. We've spoken before when we did the story of Lot and his daughters. We spoke about the importance of the line of Mashiach and of all the lineage that there is, various lines that there are in the Torah and actually in history in the world. The most important line is the Davidic line, is King David and his descendants, which results in Mashiach for whom we are waiting. That line is initiated here with the story of Yehuda and Tamar. We have spoken about in the past that because of how important this line is, therefore the Satan, which is the same thing as the Yetzer Hara, which is an angel, the angel that is charged with the job of trying to make life difficult, that is the job of the Yetzer Hara, because if it were easy to serve Hashem, then there would be no reason to reward us when we serve Him. If we had no struggles, if we had no temptation to do evil, then if when we did good, then we wouldn't be doing anything that deserved any reward. Angels don't get rewarded for listening to Hashem, because they have no choice. Animals don't get rewarded for following their instincts, because they have no choice. But we do get rewarded because we have struggles, and we have choice, and we could do one way or the other. And when we do the right thing, then we are rewarded handsomely by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, by God. Those challenges that are in our way, those temptations that are in our way, that little voice inside of us that's telling us to raise our voices, to speak the Lashon Hara, to take the extra Danish. That little voice is the Yetzer Hara at work, and it's really a good thing that he's there, because otherwise we wouldn't be rewarded for when we choose correctly. The Yetzer Hara works overtime when the matter at hand is more important. The more important the matter is, the harder the Yetzer Hara works to derail it. So that if you're dealing with, for example, marriage. Marriage is considered to be a major step for most people in their lives, and it's a powerful thing. And the Gemara says, interestingly, Les ksuba delo rami beit tigra. There is no ksuba, there's no ketubah, there's no marriage contract. Delo rami beit tigra, that does not have a fight thrown into it. The Gemara says, every marriage, at the beginning, at some point or other, there's going to be friction. Whether it's between the happy bride and groom, the chasan and kala, whether it's between the mechutanim, whether it's between the caterer and the photographer, but there's going to be friction. Just accept it. It's going to happen. Now why? Why does it have to be? Because since it's such an important step, there's going to be resistance. That's the Yetzer Hara's job. So the Yetzer Hara, as you would imagine, is most at work when it comes to the creating of and the maintaining of the Davidic line. That's where the Yetzer Hara will work overtime the most. That's where you'll find the greatest resistance. And the resistance will present itself primarily in the area of morality. Because since we're talking about a line of parent to child, father to son, which involves, obviously, physical relationships, that's where the Yetzer Hara is going to show itself the most in the Davidic line. And that's why we have so many stories within his line that are questionable morally. Starting with Lot and his daughters, which we already discussed, which eventually produces Rus, who we will read about on Shavuos, and Rus will marry Boaz. When we read about Rus and Boaz on Shavuos, we will see another questionable relationship between Rus and Boaz themselves. And here we have Yehuda and Tamar with a questionable relationship, as we're going to see as we read through the Pesukim. And here the Yetzer Hara will read the story and we will see a relationship that certainly seems questionable. And that's the way it's always going to be in the Davidic line. You know, of course, that David HaMelech, King David's major mistake in his life is with Bathsheba. And although, again, the story over there is not nearly as bad as the secular world reads it, and one day, please God, we'll learn that story. Maybe when we finish Chumash, we'll move on to Navi, and we'll read that story. But one day we'll learn that story, and we'll see what really did happen, and where King David went wrong. But again, the mistake was in a moral issue, in a relationship with a woman, and there was something amiss over there. With the Davidic line, you're going to find many cases where the relationship is either just inside the line or just outside the line. It's going to be just barely okay or just barely not okay. And that's going to be the struggle within the Davidic line. And with David and Bathsheba, that was one case where it was just slightly off. No, it was David. It was David and Bathsheba, yeah. David and Bathsheba was just slightly over the line. And again, we're not learning that story, so I can't show you now the nuances in that story and show you where it was just slightly over the line. And with Lot and his daughters, it was just slightly inside the line. With Yehuda and Tamar, we're going to see it was just slightly inside the line, just barely made it on the moral scale. And that's the way it's always going to be. Now, we know who Yehuda is, and we know that Yehuda is the one who is going to produce royalty in the Jewish people. The brothers already recognized Yehuda as a leader, as we know, because Yehuda is the one who said, no, don't kill our brother, we're going to sell him. And they all listened to him. And we said that because they listened to him, he was later blamed. They blamed him for their father's obvious suffering. The woman involved is Tamar. And many of you know that Tamar has a very exalted lineage, and she is the daughter of
Shem,
the son of Noach. You'll say Shem, the son of Noach, lived. He's 12 or 13 generations prior to this. But remember, when we learned about Shem, we showed that Shem had what I consider to be one of the most tragic lifetimes, because he outlived all his generations. He was the one in whose lifetime all his future generations, their years got shorter and shorter, where before the flood, they were living to be 900 years old or so. And then after the flood, the lifespan began to get shorter and shorter. But Shem lived still to be very, very old. 600 years or so, 650 years, I forget exactly, but he lived to be very, very old. And so as a result, 600 years, I think. So as a result, as his future generations, their lifespans got shorter and shorter, he outlived all of them. And so he was still alive when Yaakov was born. When Yaakov, now remember, Avraham is 10 generations from Noah. Yaakov is 2 generations after Avraham. Shem is the son of Noah. Shem was able to teach Yaakov Torah. he died before Yaakov ran away to Laban's house. But that's how old Shem was. That's how long he lived. So it is not shocking to find a daughter of his who was involved in a story with Yaakov's grandson, with Yehuda. And that is who Tamar is.
Does that mean that she was young, or...
No, she couldn't have been young, because Shem had passed away. So she couldn't have been that young. But I imagine she was not his oldest daughter. Then she would have been quite old. She probably would have already passed away at this point had she been that old.
Was she was older than Yehuda?
Possibly. Possibly, yeah. I guess she had to be if she was Shem's daughter, yeah.
So she was older than Yehuda.
I guess she must have been if she was Shem's daughter. Yeah, it must have been. Okay. Now tonight we're not going to get through the entire story. We'll try to cover roughly this first page here. Vayibo Esa here was at that time after they sold Yosef. Vayered Yehuda me'esachav, and Yehuda went down from his brothers, as Rashi tells us. They blamed him for their father's pain and suffering. On page 208, they blamed him. And therefore, his standing was diminished in their eyes. Vayet. Remember this word, vayet. We're going to see it again, not tonight, but we will see it again later in the story. Vayet, and he turned ad ish adulami, to an adulamite man, ushmo Chira. That man's name was Chira. Those of you who attend the Wednesday night Yechezkel class know this name Chira. We learned about him in Yechezkel because he helps Yehuda here in this story. God grants Chira a very long life, and he actually lives to assist David's son Shlomo in building the Beis HaMikdash.
Wow.
In building the temple. That's who this Chira is, according to many opinions. So he has this friend whose name is Chira. Now this friend Chira has nothing to do with Tamar, or with Yehuda marrying Tamar, or anything like that. But Chira will be a friend who will stand by Yehuda in the whole story, as we'll see. Vayar sham Yehuda bas ish Kenani, and Yehuda saw there the daughter of a Canaanite man, ushmo Shua. His name was Shua. Does not tell us her name, but the father's name was Shua. Vayikachera, and he married her, vayavo eleha, and he lived with her. Now, the word Kenani could mean Canaanite, as in the nation Canaanite, in which case you could ask, didn't Yitzchak instruct Yaakov not to take a daughter from Canaan? And here Yehuda seems to be taking a daughter of Canaan, a wife from Canaan. Mm-hmm. So it should be noted that reluctance to allow wasn't Yitzchak who instructed Yaakov. It was Rivka who said not to take from Canaan, but it was Avraham who told Eliezer not to take a wife for Yitzchak from Canaan. That reluctance to take from Canaan was only for the patriarchs. The Shvatim, the tribes, one opinion holds they all married Canaanite women. That's where they were living, and that's who they married. And remember, before the Torah was given, there was no such thing as a convert. We discussed this in other classes. Even if you say there was conversion, but the conversion had to be through marriage. The way that you became Jewish was marrying into Yaakov's family. And so some say, there's two opinions. Some say that the brothers married their half-sisters, which was permitted before the Torah was given. That they married because each brother had a twin sister that was born with them, and those twin sisters married the other brothers. That was one opinion. The other opinion is that they married Canaanite women. And so that Yehuda would marry a Canaanite woman is not so strange, especially according to that opinion, that that's what all the brothers did. However, the word Kenani has a dual meaning. It can also mean merchant. The word can mean merchant. So if you say that it means merchant, and that's what Rashi says over here, then we don't know this woman's nationality. We just know that her father was a merchant. So her father's name was Shua, and Yehuda marries her. Vatahar, she becomes pregnant. Vatelet Bain, she gave birth to a son. Vayikra es Shemo Er, and Yehuda named that firstborn Er. Vatahar od Vatelet Bain, she became pregnant again, and she gave birth to a son. Vatikra es Shemo Onan, they were trading off, and that was her turn. She named the second son Onan. Vatosef od Vatelet Bain, she continued again, and she gave birth to a son. Vatikra es Shemo Shelah, and she called his name Shelah. Apparently Yehuda did not take his turn over here. It went to her again, and she named him Shelah. V'hayav v'chziv b'lidata oso, and and it was in Kiziv where she gave birth to him. Now Kiziv simply means a place called Kiziv. However, Kiziv can also mean to lie, or to lie, not as in I told you a lie, not a fib, but the word Kiziv is used, for example, if you have a river and the river dries up, that's called Yechazvu Meimav. Its waters have lied. His waters have lied, which means have dried up. So here, what some say this means is that she stopped giving birth. She had three sons, and now she no longer has a child. And now she's no longer giving birth. He noticed that this was it. She had Er, Onan, and Shelah, and now she is unable to bear any more children, or is not bearing any more children. Okay. So, now that she's not bearing any more children, apparently as long as she was bearing children, as long as she was bearing children, it seems that Yehuda was not focused on his children marrying. But once his wife stopped bearing children, now he became focused on his children having children. Yehuda took a wife for Er, his firstborn, Ushma Tamar. Her name was Tamar. This is Tamar, the daughter of Shem. Vayihi Er Bechor Yehuda Rabbeinei Hashem. And Er, the firstborn of Yehuda, was evil in the eyes of Hashem. That's significant. Evil in the eyes of Hashem implies no one else thought he was evil. If you would have met him on the street, you would have assumed that he's a very righteous man. But he was evil in the eyes of Hashem. Vayemisehu Hashem. So Hashem killed him, for he was evil in Hashem's eyes. Now this is extremely important to understand. Er was, to all appearances, a very righteous man, very worthy of being the son of Yehuda, of being the ancestor of King David, of being the ancestor of royalty. That's what everybody assumed, including Yehuda. But Hashem knew better. And he was evil in the eyes of Hashem, so Hashem killed him.
Do we know in which way he was evil?
Yes, we'll see in a minute. Vayomer Yehuda le'onan, Yehuda said to Onan, Bo el eshes sachicha, live with the wife of your brother, v'yabem osa, and do yibum to her, which they translate as a leveret marriage, v'hakem zera le'achicha, and establish seed for your brother. This is a mitzvah in the Torah, which, of course, the Torah had not been given yet, but there is a mitzvah in the Torah, which is given later on, that if a man dies, God forbid, without children, then his brother has the mitzvah to marry his wife. And if he marries his wife, the first child is considered to be the heir to the brother who had passed away. This is a very interesting mitzvah, because normally, a brother's wife is prohibited. A sister-in-law is prohibited under normal circumstances, meaning, let's give it names, Reuven and Shimon. Reuven gets married, Shimon is his brother. Reuven dies or divorces his wife. Shimon is not allowed to marry Reuven's wife. That is considered to be a form of immorality, of incest, as far as the Torah is concerned. It's no different than marrying a sister. It's absolutely prohibited. However, in this specific case, where Reuven had no children, then there is a mitzvah for Shimon to marry Reuven's wife. If he doesn't want to marry her, then there is a way out called chalitza, which is described later in the Torah, of how not to do it. Today, it should just be noted that Yibum is never performed, because we are concerned that it will not be performed properly, that the brother who is marrying his sister-in-law will not do it with the proper intentions, and it is very much discouraged. We don't do it today, and instead we opt for the way out, which is chalitza, which, as I said, is described later in the Torah. So that's why you don't hear of it today. Chalitza is done today, but you never hear of Yibum, because that has been banned for many years.
Oh, banned?
Well, it's no rabbi would allow it. Not today.
Even if they want to.
And they won't allow it. They won't allow it today. But it is in the Torah, and the concept, conceptually, the idea is Reuven has no heir, so when Reuven dies, he has no one who continues his family, and so when Shimon marries Reuven's wife, Shimon may already have a wife, and he has his own children. When he marries Reuven's wife, that first child is considered to be the heir to Reuven. It's as if Reuven had a child, and now he bears Reuven's name, and he carries on the legacy of his, not his father, but his father's brother, of the one who passed away, Reuven. That's the idea. Now, it's important to understand what it is conceptually, because we're going to see it here used a little differently than the way the Torah normally uses it. Here, we have it the way the Torah does, and say it later. But later in the story, we're going to see it used in a slightly different manner. So, Onan marries, well, Yehuda tells Onan to marry Er's wife, Tamar. Vayeda Onan knew, ki lo yeazara, that not to him would be the child, the seed. He understood that whoever Tamar would give birth to would not be considered Onan's child, rather it would be considered Er's child. And here we have what is called Onanism, or whatever the, however the English term is. V'haya im ba el eshes achiv v'shiches arza, and it was when he would live with the wife of his brother, and he would destroy towards the ground. Leviltinus son Zera le'achiv, not to give seed to his brother. So he would, in order to avoid his wife Tama becoming pregnant, whenever he would live with her, he would make sure that the seed would not go into her, but rather to the ground. So that was in order to avoid her becoming pregnant. Vayera be'enei Hashem. It was evil in the eyes of God, that which he did. Again, in the eyes of God. No one else knew what he was doing. Now we understand why no one else knew what he was doing, because what he was doing was a very private matter. It was done in the privacy of their own bedroom. No one else knew about it, except for perhaps his wife Tamar. And he was avoiding making her pregnant by wasting the seed. And so, Vayames Gam Oso, God killed him as well. This word Gam also tips us off. Now we understand why Er died. You see, the word also, our sages understand, is teaching us that Er died for the same reason Onan died. It was the same type of sin. Only God knew. He was evil in the eyes of God, not in the eyes of man. No one else knew what he was doing wrong. It was in the eyes of God. Why? Because he did the same sin as Onan, which is that when he lived with Tamar, he did not want her to become pregnant, and so he would, again, waste the seed. This is what Er did as well. Now, the question is, what was Er's motivation? Onan, we understand his motivation. We may not condone his motivation, but we understand Torah tells us why he did it. He did it because he didn't want to have a child that would be called by his brother's name, which is very selfish. But that was his motivation. But what was Er's motivation? Why did he do the same thing? And the Torah and the our sages tell us, Rashi quotes it, because he didn't want Tamar to become pregnant, which would then, I say this, Wait, I said that we have a pregnant woman in the room. Which would diminish her beauty. I can only say that we have 8 children, and I'm married to a beautiful wife. We don't have to, right? Okay. But that is the reality of the matter, and that's what Er did not want. Now, that seems even more selfish than what Onan did. Okay, so we're going to discuss these two things in a moment. But that's what happened. But bear in mind that neither with Er nor with Onan did anyone know that they did anything wrong, except for Tamar. And Tamar, as we know from later in the story, was not about to tell anybody anything about something that somebody did wrong. Tamar is the quintessential Shmiras Halashon woman. She's the one who guards her tongue and never says speaks evil about anybody, even when it's to her own detriment. It's from her that we learn how far you have to go to avoid embarrassing other people. And we're going to see that later in the story. That's her great accomplishment. So no one knew why they were dying. Now, you could have said that they must have both done something terribly wrong. That's what you could have said. You could have said, Er must have done something wrong even though you couldn't see it. Onan must have done something wrong even though you couldn't have seen it. Even though their characters seem to be sterling, they seem to be wonderful people, that could have been one conclusion you would draw. The other possible conclusion you would draw is, Tamar must be doing something wrong, which is why her husbands keep dying. Now, if you have a choice of saying, Er looks like a great guy, Ona looks like a great guy, Tamar looks like a great woman, there's something wrong here. Something is not what meets the eye. Either Er and Onan are both evil, or Tamar is evil. That's your choice, but it's got to be one or the other. Something's happening here. It's not natural, and it's not what meets the eye. So if you have a choice of saying that coincidentally both Er and Onan are bad, or not coincidentally Tamar is bad, well, the logical thing, your good money would be to put it on Tamar being the bad one, which is what you.
She's the one who's still alive.
But at least it would be the same. She's still alive. But at least you're blaming the same person for both deaths. It is striking that both Er and Onan did the same thing wrong. Why should they do the same thing wrong? And we know it's for two different reasons. They happen to do the exact same sin. But why? If the Torah wouldn't have told it to us, it would be hard to guess that. That's why Yehuda jumps to conclusions and assumes Tamar must be the culprit. That is the logical conclusion.
Besides, she's not his child.
Okay, that's also true. But we know that we're going to see that he understood that Tamar was a great lady. That he understood. He knew that. That's why he took her for Er, as we'll see. Let's finish the story up. But you're right. That could be another reason. So he jumps to conclusions. Vayomer Yehuda leTamar. Yehuda said to Tamar, the Tamar kalaso to Tamar his daughter-in-law. A kala, by the way, literally means a daughter-in-law. A chasan means a son-in-law. We call them bride and groom, a kala and a chasan, but literally means son-in-law, daughter-in-law. So he said to Tamar his daughter-in-law, Shivi almana veSavich. Dwell as an almana, as a widow, in the house of your father. It doesn't mean literally her father. Father had passed away. Shem had passed away. But it means in his household. Ad yigdal Shela v'ni, until my son Shela gets older. Now, Shela was young. So he said, we're going to wait till Shela gets older. Now, that's what he told her. But that's not what he was thinking. What was he really thinking? Ki amar, for he said to himself, Kan yamus kam hu ke'achav. Maybe Shela will die just like his brothers died. And my wife, the daughter of Shua, is not having any more children. Who's going to produce the Davidic line? Er was my number one choice. He's dead. Onan was my second choice. He's dead. Who's left? Shelah. I'm not risking Shelah on this woman. She's killing my sons. I'm not risking it. Maybe he'll die like his brothers. But that's not what he told her. He told her, go dwell there until he grows up. Batelech Tamar, and Tamar went, Batesha Faisavia, and she dwelled in the house of her father. Okay, let's stop there for a moment.
The house of her father, is he still alive then?
No, he's not still alive, but in her father's family's house. So we're going to stop there, for the moment means until next Sunday. And we're going to pick up from there. The next part of the story, as you know, is that Shelah is going to grow up, and Yehuda is not taking Tamar for Shelah. Tamar's going to realize that he's not taking me. What's going on here? And then Tamar's going to take the matter into her own hands, which will need its own explanation. But let's focus right now first on what happened over here with Er and with Onan, what their motivations were, and what they did. And let's answer a question. Let's answer a question. Yehuda here is out to create the Davidic line.
How does he know?
He knows because he has been slated for royalty. He understands that he is in a leadership role amongst the brothers. It is not coincidental that he focuses on this once Yosef is gone. See, as long as Yosef was around, then Yosef might have been the father of royalty. Yosef also holds a claim to royalty. As we know, there are really two Mashiachs that are coming in the future. One is Mashiach ben David, the descendant of King David, who comes from Yehuda. And the other one is Mashiach ben Yosef. We know that when the kingdom split way back when, and you had the Davidic line in the southern kingdom, the northern kingdom, who were the kings of the northern kingdom? It was Yosef's descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. They're the ones who were the kings of the northern, Malchus Yisrael, the northern kingdom. As long as Yosef was around, it could be, it wasn't 100% clear where would the royalty come from. But once Yosef was sold, and as far as the brothers were concerned, he was out of the picture. He was no longer going to be part of the Jewish people. He was out. Then Yehuda now had to focus on creating the Davidic line. And so he goes and marries a woman who is unnamed, who doesn't seem to have any credentials, and he has sons. And then he takes this woman, Tamar, who is, her credentials are impeccable. She's an incredible woman. She has a great lineage, and she herself is a great righteous woman, and takes her for his son, heir, and he thinks, this is it. This is going to be the perfect match where we're going to create the Davidic line. Later, as we know, he's going to marry Tamar himself. He doesn't realize it, but that's what's going to happen in the end. And from there will come the Davidic line. That's what will end up happening. Why didn't Yehuda take Tamar in the first place? Why does he go and marry the daughter of Shua, has heir, and marries heir to Tamar? Go marry Tamar yourself. If you know that you're creating the Davidic line, which is why you went and got this perfect woman, Tamar, for your son, heir, you do it yourself. It is clear that Yehuda did not deem himself worthy of being the one to marry Tamar. He did not deem himself worthy. As the story begins, and that's why the beginning of the story, the way the Torah introduces a story, always tips you off to the story. Let's read the first verse again. Vayehi ba'es ahi, it was at that time. Vayered Yehuda me'es echav. And Yehuda went down from the status that he had enjoyed amongst his brothers. Yehuda had been diminished. Yehuda understood that he had done wrong. And therefore, although he still felt Yosef had to be gotten rid of, that Yosef, as we've explained before, was a rodef, was out to kill the other brothers, not kill physically, but spiritually, to get them out of the picture. And therefore, Yosef had to go. But Yehuda felt, since he had blood on his hands, again, he didn't kill Yosef, but he's the one who got Yosef sold, he felt that it was not he who should be marrying Tamar. And therefore, he felt he knew it had to come from him, he had to produce a child, and that child would then marry Tamar. And that's what happened. Er and Onan each do the same sin. What's happening over here? So as we started with in our introduction, the Yetzer Hara is going to work overtime in trying to undermine the Davidic line, that it should not be created in the first place, and once it is created, to try to derail it, to try to ruin it. There are times in history, more than a couple of times in history, where the Davidic line was hanging on by a thread. It had nearly been killed out. Those of you who are familiar with the story of Rus know that that's what happened in that story, but it happened again in Sefer Malachim, in the Book of Kings, that happened. It happened actually twice in the Book of Kings, where the line was very, very precarious, or it was almost wiped out. As we mentioned, the Yetzer Hara's way of trying to undermine this line is in the area of morality. And therefore, what the Yetzer Hara will do is create an unnatural desire in the person involved, in the man involved in the story, in an attempt to get him to do a sin. That's what happens with Er. That's what happens with Onan. No one would have suspected that they would do what they did. Er did it to preserve her beauty. To preserve her beauty? Er understood that he's producing David HaMelech. Er understood what it meant for her to become pregnant, that he's going to create a Davidic line, and yet her beauty is more important. Now I suspect that he didn't mean that she should never become pregnant. I suspect that in his own mind he was thinking, that for a little while I'll preserve her beauty, and later she'll become pregnant and will produce the line that we need to produce. But it doesn't have to be right now.
Did she also knew about...
They understood that the descendants of Yehuda throughout history understood their role. We see it in the story of Rus. It's something which they understood very well. Onan also knew, but Onan did not want that it should be his brother's child. He wanted it to be his child, and so he didn't want to produce a child through her either. And so they both acted in a selfish way within the area of a physical relationship with morality. And they both did wrong. But it was an unnatural desire that they had. The way that we understand that it was unnatural is because no one suspected it. There are people in the world who we could suspect, even though we do not know what goes on in their private lives. But the way they act on the outside makes us suspect that the way they act on the inside can't be too great. Right? You see how they act, and you can suspect that. There are other people who you say, you know what, the way they act on the outside seems fine, but we don't know what's going on the inside. And since we don't know, you never know. And sometimes we're shocked. We find out terrible things about a person when we thought that they were really great people, and it turns out they weren't so great on the inside. That can happen as well. But then there are people who it's impossible to conceive that they would do anything wrong. That's what Aaron and Onan were. That they would do something like this was only in the eyes of God that he saw it, because no one else knew. It was beyond shocking. It was beyond the possibility of beyond comprehension that it could happen. Just one second. And so, Aaron Onan, though, failed. They failed. They had that extra desire, and instead, it destroyed them. Now, if you think about it, the Yetzer Hara is an angel. It doesn't have its own choice. There always has to be a good and a bad. What's the real reason why they had the extra desire? Because it was important for them to produce a child. That was the important thing that had to happen over here. Er had a desire for Tamar because it was his job to produce a child. To produce that child that would eventually produce David HaMelech. That's what it was there for. After all, what's the reason why God has put into this world that men and women are attracted to each other? What's the reason for that attraction? God just did it? The reason for the attraction is to produce children. That's the reason. That doesn't mean that every time that a man and a woman are together, they must produce children. But the purpose of that desire on a grand scheme of things is to produce children. That's the reason for it. Er had an unnatural desire because he was about to produce what was arguably the most important child up to that point in time. Onan as well. They both failed. We will see later in the story that it is precisely through an unnatural desire that Yehuda does produce the child that he was supposed to produce. That's exactly what happens with Yehuda, but there it works to his advantage. And we'll see that later in the story, how that plays itself out. Yes, question?
Do people not wonder why Tamar wasn't getting pregnant when she was married to
Reza? I don't know how quickly this happened. I imagine it was quick. I imagine that
Hashem.
Yeah, I imagine it was quick. I do want to... Yes, go ahead.
Before Onan married Tamar, did he have children with his wife? Already?
It doesn't tell us one way or another. And we don't even know if he was married. They were young. Both Aaron and Onan were young. Because remember that Yosef is sold for a total of 22 years. The time span from the moment he's sold till they find him is 22 years. All this whole story happens during those 22 years. So Yehuda marries, has Er, Onan, and Shelah. They get old enough to marry. They marry Tamar. So we're not talking about 30, 40-year-old men. We're talking about boys in their teens. That's what we're talking about over here at best. I want to point out, just so we just don't miss it over here, it's almost 9 o'clock, I do want to point out that this is where the halachic discussion, the Torah law discussion of contraception comes in. Because since there is a prohibition against what Aaron Onan did, therefore contraception can only, in a permissible way, can only be done where it does not involve what Aaron Onan did. So defining, we're not going to get into it obviously in this class, but defining what it is that you can't do and what it is that is permissible is where the discussion of contraception comes in. So practically speaking, in today's day and age, where I mean, contraception only recently were there many methods that have come into practical use. But practically speaking, there is a discussion amongst the post, amongst the decisors, as to which methods are permissible, which are not, and that has to do with what happened over here, and that's why it is some are permissible and some are actually prohibited, and that's where it comes into discussion because of this story over here. Okay, so next week, Emir Tashem, we will continue the story. We will see then what happens with Yehuda and Tamar, and how that we'll see the same theme continues to show itself throughout the story. Next week we go back to regular time, 7:30 to 8:30.